It's really a pleasure to be back here at the Economic Club of Minnesota. It's remarkable how much the organization has grown and taken root in just 6 years, and we owe a lot to the leadership of Mark Kennedy and Tim Penny for making that happen. So I'm going to begin my speech today with some basics about the Federal Reserve System and the Federal Open Market Committee, the FOMC. But the bulk of my remarks should be viewed as a quarterly report of sorts. Your elected representatives, the Congress of the United States, has charged the Federal Reserve with achieving key macroeconomic goals. My speech will be a report to you about how the FOMC is doing in terms of achieving those goals. But please keep in mind that I will be expressing my own views, and they're not necessarily those of others in the Federal Reserve System. And I look forward to responding to and learning from your questions at the conclusion of my remarks. Let me begin with some basics about the Federal Reserve System. So I like to tell people that the Fed is a uniquely American institution. What do I mean when I say that? Well, relative to its counterparts around the world, the U.S. Central Bank is highly decentralized. The Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis is one of 12 regional reserve banks that, along with the Board of Governors in Washington, D.C., make up the Federal Reserve System. So our bank represents the ninth of the 12 Federal Reserve districts, and that district includes the state of Montana, North and South Dakota, Minnesota, northwestern Wisconsin, and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. So 8 times per year, the FOMC meets to set the path of interest rates over the next 6 to 7 weeks. All 12 presidents of the various Federal Reserve Banks, including myself, and the 7 governors of the Federal Reserve Board contribute to these deliberations. However, the committee itself consists only of the governors, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and a rotating group of 4 other presidents. And I'm one of those 4 other presidents this year. So in this way, the structure of the FOMC mirrors the federal structure of our government, because representatives from different regions of the country, the various presidents, have input into FOMC deliberations. Now, at those 8 meetings, the FOMC decides on the level of monetary stimulus for the economy. I'm not going to get into too many details of what that term monetary stimulus means in my speech, although I'm more than happy to take questions about it later. For now, I'm going to make 3 high-level points. First, when the FOMC changes the level of stimulus, our actions tend to push inflation, that is the rate of growth of prices, and employment in the same direction. Raising the level of stimulus puts upward pressure on both prices and employment. Lowering the level of stimulus puts downward pressure on both inflation and employment. So the second point I want to make is the FOMC's actions only affect inflation and employment with a lag, usually thought to be about 1.5 to 2 years. Finally, over the long run, monetary policy is the prime determinant of the overall rate of inflation in the economy. But the long run level of employment is shaped by many factors beyond monetary policy. So what are we trying to do when we meet to vary the level of monetary stimulus? And this gets to our congressional goals, what Congress has charged us to do. Congress has charged the FOMC with making monetary policy to do 2 things: to promote price stability and to promote maximum employment. And the FOMC has interpreted the first goal, price stability, to mean keeping inflation close to 2%. And the FOMC's job is to vary monetary stimulus in order to meet these mandated objectives. And the remainder of my speech will largely take the form of a report to you about how the FOMC is doing in terms of meeting those goals that have been set for us by your elected representatives in Congress. Okay, so I talked about 2 goals, and the first is was price stability. So operationally, again, to remind you, the FOMC has translated this into keeping the rate of increase at the price level, that is the inflation rate, close to 2%. And I'll come back and use this term, the price level, again. Price level refers to the price of a typical bundle of goods and services how much people would pay for a typical bundle of price goods and services in the United States. Even more specifically, The FOMC uses what's called the Personal Consumption Expenditure Price Index, or PCE, to calculate inflation. This is a very broad basket of goods and services. The main thing is to keep in mind is that this measure of inflation that we're targeting captures the rate of increase in all goods and services, including those related to food and energy. Okay, so the Great Recession is dated as having started in December 2007. So here's a graph of how PC inflation has behaved since the beginning of the Great Recession in December 2007. So since December 2007, PC inflation has averaged about 1.5% per year. Now, and so that gray-shaded area, and this will show up again on the charts, represents the period of the Great Recession. This is dated as having started at the end of 2007 and ending about the middle of 2009. Now, in some sense, going back to 2007 is a little misleading, because I made reference to the 2% target for the FOMC, but the official adoption of that 2% target didn't take place until January of 2012. And that's why you see that green line, which was labeled FOMC target, it doesn't start till the beginning of 2012. A little ironically, since that decision to adopt the FOMC, the target rate of inflation of 2%, the PC inflation has continued to drift downward. And currently, you'll see that the year-over-year PC inflation rate is running slightly above 1%. So if you look back over the past 6 years or so, or you look back over the past 2 years, inflation is running too low to be consistent with what we consider price stability. Now, this is looking backwards, and I've told you that monetary policy operates with a forward lag. And the good news is that the FOMC does expect inflation to return to 2%. But I expect that return to 2% to take a long time, possibly in the order of four years. And I'm not the only one forecasting a slow return to 2% inflation. If you go back to earlier this year, the Congressional Budget Office released its forecast for the U.S. economy, and they're predicting that inflation will not reach 2% until the year 2018, so 4 years from now. So to sum up, I think to summarize where we are in terms of the price stability goal, the FOMC is undershooting its price stability objective. I've said this is going to be a report to you, but I'm going to take a slight detour to talk a little bit more about inflation. I've told you that inflation has been and will be too low relative to the FOMC's target of 2%. But why should you care? Why should you care that inflation, that is too low? Isn't it a good thing when goods and services aren't as expensive to buy? There are two answers to this, I think, a very good question. The first thing is that borrowers and lenders in our economy count on the Federal Reserve to deliver the inflation rate that it promises, that it's targeting. If inflation is higher than the target, then lenders are harmed because they receive payments that are smaller than they expected in real terms. To put that more concretely, they're going to be getting the same amount of dollars, of course, but if inflation turns out to be higher than expected, they can buy fewer goods and services with that same amount of dollars. Now, on the other hand, though, if inflation it turns out to be lower than expected, then borrowers are harmed because they must make payments that are larger than they expected in real terms. So, you know, to be even more concrete about that, when inflation is below target, goods and services are indeed cheaper, but wages also tend to be lower. And then depressed wages will mean that a family's mortgage payment is going to consume a larger fraction of the family's income. So again, the mortgage payment is remaining fixed in dollars, but if your wage is lower, as it will tend to be if inflation's low, then you're going to have to work more hours to be able to pay off that mortgage. So that's the harm on the borrowers if we have inflation running too low, and the FOMC can prevent that by achieving the inflation rate that's targeted. That's a very direct explanation of why the FOMC should keep inflation close to target. The second answer is you should care about below target inflation because of what it says about our economy It's a signal that there's a significant problem in our economy. So let me explain what I mean by that. At a basic level, you should be thinking of prices as a signal about how our economy is using its available resources. So, you know, you can read about this in textbooks, but in 2012, I had an experience that just brought this home in a very clear way. I visited Williston, North Dakota, which is on the western edge of North Dakota. And as it is today, when I visited Williston, it was in the heart of a major oil boom. That oil boom was pushing hard on the physical resources, like roads, water, housing, available to Williston, and also pushing hard on the human resources available to Williston. And the result was that if you focused on that portion of our district, you focused on that portion of our country, you actually saw inflation running relatively high in Williston. So when inflation is high compared to the Fed's target, like it was in Williston, we can infer that demand is pushing hard on available resources. And the converse is also true. When inflation is low compared to the Fed's target, that's going to be a signal to us that the demand for goods and services is too low in the economy to fully use the available resources in society. That low rate of inflation in the United States tells us that, in fact, we're wasting resources. Now, what are these resources that are being wasted? There are multiple answers to this question. When demand is too low, we're actually leaving lots of resources unused. But the biggest and most disturbing answer to this is our fellow Americans. There are many productive people in the United States available to work more hours, and our society is being deprived of their production by the fact that demand is as low as it is. So I think this is a second point about the low inflation is generally underappreciated. I've said that the FOMC is undershooting its price stability objective and is expected to continue to do so. But we should be keeping in mind that this outcome and this forecast for continued undershooting typically means that the FOMC is underperforming on its other objective of promoting maximum employment. Okay, so I've described how I expected the PC inflation rate will run below the FOMC's 2% target for several years, possibly until 2018. Let's assume that forecast turns out to be right. This outcome raises a key policy question. How should the FOMC's inflation goals in the years following 2018 be influenced by the undershooting of the inflation target in the preceding years? So again, let's assume that inflation runs low, below 2% over the next 4 years, as I suggested. Suppose that turns out to be true. How should the FOMC's policy going forward, how should its inflation goals in the years following 2018 be influenced by its undershooting the inflation target before 2018? So I'm going to talk about that in two different ways: the standard approach of inflation targeting and a more novel approach, which is typically called price level targeting. Let me note before I begin that I won't take a stand on which of those approaches is better. My goal is to simply initiate a policy conversation about future, indeed possibly far-off future, monetary policy choices. So the FOMC announced its 2% inflation target in January of 2012. So this graph starts accordingly in the beginning of 2012. Since that date, beginning of January of 2012, inflation has averaged about 1.3% per year. Like the CBO, I anticipate that the inflation rate will rise only slowly. And here we've actually sketched exactly what the CBO announces its forecast about 3 months ago, returning to target in the FOMC's target in about 2018. As you know, as we've talked about, the inflation rate is the growth rate of the price level, which is how much people pay for a typical bundle of goods and services. So the downside misses with respect to inflation accumulate over time in terms of how they affect the prices you pay. So in particular, this is going below 2% all along here until 2018 means that the price level in 2018 will be about 2.5% below what would have been had the FOMC hit its inflation target over the preceding 6 years. So we get to 2018, where you see the CBO forecast running below 2%, we actually have to every time we're low relative to 2%, that's affecting the price level that people are going to be paying actually in 2018 itself. And my question is, how should the FOMC respond to this shortfall in the price level? And there are two choices that I think I'm going to talk about today. One is that the FOMC could simply target a 2% inflation rate after 2018. And that's shown on just the bottom line here. You see the CBO forecast. That's the dotted line. We get to 2018, and then the question is, what happens next? And we could continue along the dotted line. That would be inflation targeting. If you keep hitting your target at 2% inflation, that sounds good, but that's going to mean at the price level, you're not making up for all the misses you had in the past. So the price level is going to stay at 2.5% below what was expected in 2012. And this is what people call inflation targeting. That's why it's labeled there, inflation targeting. The other way to proceed is that the FOMC could target a slightly higher inflation rate for a few years after 2018. And that's at the orange arrow. And to get back to the path that we were supposed to be on is of 2012. Now, why would we want to do that? Why would we want to use price level targeting? There are two reasons for this, and they're closely related to the concerns about low inflation I raised earlier. The first reason is price level targeting makes long-term contracts safer for borrowers and lenders. So suppose a family took out a mortgage in 2012, a 30-year mortgage, under the expectation that the FOMC would deliver on its commitment to keep inflation at 2%. Because inflation has been so low over the past 2 years, the borrower's current repayments are now surprisingly expensive in real terms. That, you know, as we talked about, they have to devote a larger fraction of their paycheck to paying off those mortgage payments. The FOMC cannot solve that problem today, of course, but if the FOMC uses inflation targeting, the borrower's repayments are likely to remain surprisingly expensive in real terms even in 2042. The price level, how much goods and services are costing is low. That means your wages you're getting are going to have to, you're going to have more of that in order to pay off the mortgage, even 30 years later. So that line, the dotted line and the red arrow, is just going to keep on going. We could draw it out to 2042, and you're still going to have to be paying a relatively high, the borrower's repayments will still likely be to be too expensive in real terms compared to what the borrower expected. Now, instead, if you use price level targeting, you get back to this path that you were on, that you were supposed to be on as of 2012, and now the borrower's repayments, you know, certainly there's been a period in which the repayments are too expensive, but by the time you get back to 2042, and even before that, of course, the repayments are what would have been expected in real terms by the borrower and by the lender as well. If you get back to the black path, constant 2% inflation, that path represents the expectations of what borrowers and lenders both had as of 2012. Now, the second reason the FOMC might want to use price level targeting beyond making contracts safe for borrowers and lenders is it serves as an automatic stabilizer for the economy. I described earlier, when demand is low, inflation tends to be below target. With price level targeting, the FOMC automatically makes up for that low inflation by using monetary policy to stimulate higher future inflation. As I've described here, those misses up to 2018 lead to higher inflation after 2018, above 2% inflation. That leads to higher future demand. That's associated, I should say, with higher future demand. In fact, you've got higher inflation. Just as I talked about in Wilson, higher inflation is associated with higher demand there. And this prospect of higher future demand serves as an incentive for businesses to hire and invest more now. So with price level targeting, the FOMC's anticipated future policy choices automatically offset current adverse shocks. A downturn leads to lower inflation than you might have expected, but that's offset by the fact that in the future, we're going to have higher future demand. Now, I framed this discussion about inflation targeting versus price level targeting in terms of what's going to happen after 2018. But I just talked through, these decisions that are about policy after 2018 have the potential to affect near-term macroeconomic outcomes. If the FOMC were to decide today to follow price level targeting, then businesses would anticipate more stimulated monetary policy, and they would therefore anticipate higher future demand. That would be a additional incentive for them to hire today and invest more today. So in this way, really, a decision that about price level targeting or inflation targeting, a decision that's really about choices to be made several years from now, really has the potential to affect the near-term speed of the economy's recovery. Now, I suspect that this discussion about price level targeting versus inflation targeting might seem a little dry to some of you, but this is about as exciting as central banking can get. It's not a joke. I'm certainly not trying to resolve that debate today. And in particular, I've not talked about a very important question. It's a challenging question about how the FOMC should respond to past overshooting of its inflation target. I've talked about what should happen in response to undershooting, but what about in response to overshooting? But I do think this question of how whether we should be targeting inflation rate or the price level should be a topic for serious discussion among central bankers here in the United States, but really, really globally as well. Okay, so enough about prices. Let me turn now to the second mandate, the max employment. And I've argued the low inflation rate is a signal the FOMC is underperforming with respect to its maximum employment objective. But we don't need it to rely on this signal to reach this conclusion. You know, one way to see this is by looking at the unemployment rate. In March of 2007 in the United States, the unemployment rate was 4.4%. And it rose slowly throughout 2007 to reach 5% by the end of the year. So by the end of 2007, we were at 5%. That's when the Great Recession's data has having started. In the wake of the recession, unemployment rates soared to 10% in October 2009. So since that date, over 4 years ago, the unemployment rate has fallen to 6.3%. This is still unusually high relative to the past quarter century or so, and it remains also high relative to where most forecasts of its expected long-run level would be. And my own expectation is that the long-run unemployment rate will converge to just over 5%. So the unemployment rate is 6.3%, definitely an improvement of where we were, 10%, but it certainly is a sign that the U.S. labor market is still not healthy. But this measure, the 6.3% unemployment rate, troubling as it is, I think it could well be an overstatement of the degree of improvement in U.S. labor markets. To estimate the unemployment rate, the Census Bureau asks people two questions. Are you working? And if you're not working, have you looked for work in the past 4 weeks? The unemployment rate measures the ratio of the second number, the recent job searchers, to the sum of the two numbers, the recent job searchers and the workers. That means when unemployment goes down, the unemployment rate goes down, it can go down for two reasons. One is that people are finding work. Okay, that's the more natural one. But it also could be that fewer people are looking for work. Most of the declines in the unemployment rate since October of 2009 have occurred because the fraction of people who are looking for work has fallen. And this is just not an idle claim. You can see this by looking at this graph, which is the evolution of the fraction of people over the age of 16 who have a job, what's called the employment to population ratio. If you go back to March of 2007, the employment to population ratio was over 63%. It fell sharply during the Great Recession, so that gray shaded area that's to the far right, and bottomed out at just over 58% in mid-2011. Now, if you look closely, you can see improvement in that number, but you have to look very closely. It's risen a little from this low point and remains lower than at any time between 1986 and 2007. Now, you have to be a little bit careful here, because even if we hadn't had a recession, demographic forces would have pushed down the employment-to-population ratio. The baby boom birth cohort, born between 1946 and 1964, is very large. As they age, the fraction of retirees should grow in the population. We would expect this fraction to fall as a result. But these demographic forces are not enough to account for the behavior of the employment-to-population ratio we're talking about seeing here. So one way we look at this in the Minneapolis Fed is to focus on people who are aged 25 to 54. And that gets rid of the people who we're focusing on people who are outside of the normal retirement age. Here, you can see the demographic forces by seeing that we have seen more improvement in this ratio. You see the basic pattern that peaking around March 2007, falling sharply during the Great Recession, very slow recovery. But you know, definitely a more distinct signs of recovery in this ratio than, and especially recently, than in the employment population ratio without the adjustment for age. But even if we don't, even if we look at, this is all looking at people who don't have a job. Even if we look at people, even if we look at people who have a job, I would say there are signs that the economy is significantly underemploying its human resources. So the Bureau of Labor Statistics reports each month on the number of Americans who are working part-time, who would like to work more hours, but are unable to find those hours. And that fraction of the labor force has fallen, but remains unusually high. Unfortunately, this series doesn't go back as far as some of the other ones we have available, but this is the working part-time for economic reasons, working part-time because you can't find extra hours. Rose, of course, sharply during the Great Recession, and again has come down, but has not come down as much as what you would see in the recovery in the unemployment rate. So the takeaway from all these charts is this. Labor market has improved since the end of the Great Recession. The rate of improvement has been really slow, painfully slow. And there's still significant underutilization of our country's most important resources, its people. So I said that the FOMC is undershooting with respect to its price stability goal, and it's underperforming now, I think we can see, with respect to its goal of promoting maximum employment. So let me sum up. I asked you to consider this speech as a report to you on the FOMC's performance with respect to its two congressionally mandated objectives. The FOMC is undershooting its price stability objective in that inflation is running well below the FOMC's goal of 2% and is expected to remain low for several years. The undershooting is problematic in part because it suggests that the American economy is wasting available resources, especially its human resources. And we've seen that strong evidence that underutilization in the performance of key labor market metrics. So the FOMC is also underperforming with respect to its maximum employment objective. I continue to believe that we need to do better with respect to our goals as a committee. Thank you very much for listening, and I'd be happy to take your questions.
We do have time for at least a few, if not several, questions. I appreciate the two main themes of your presentation, and at the risk of taking you into another topic, I am curious about the assertion that the low interest rate environment that monetary policy has created has really exacerbated the economic inequality issue, in that those with resources to invest are now investing in the stock market because it's the only place they can get a return. And now economic inequality is the big political debate on the scene in Washington. How do you react to that? What are your observations about that?
Yeah,
and I think you need...
Do I need that or not? I have a lapel mic. I think. Can people hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is an excellent question, and I'll answer it in two pieces. So the first thing to say is that monetary policy does have distributional consequences, and we're very aware of that. But ultimately, monetary policy is about our objectives, our goals, and doing what we can to achieve the goals that have been set for us by Congress. So whatever the distributional consequences might be, we're charged with doing what we can to facilitate a rapid return to 2% inflation and a rapid return to maximum employment. Having said all that, I mean, I think that monetary policy has been very helpful during this period in facilitating a more rapid recovery than we would have seen otherwise. I've emphasized how slow the recovery has been, but without the actions that have been taken, and they've been extraordinary actions, I do think the pace of recovery would have been slower. I think we would have seen higher unemployment rates. We'd have seen more long-term unemployment, and I think that would have been caused even more inequality than we've seen. Actually, our annual report essay that came out of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis a couple of weeks ago is on exactly this topic, on inequality. And not taking any stands on any of the issues, because the Fed is always neutral on these kinds of matters, but more trying to lay out some of the facts so that people know what they're talking about when they talk about inequality. I encourage you all to read it. I think it's very fascinating.
We do have a question over here. Identify yourself quickly and then pose your question.
Hi, it's Pat Williams. I'm interested in what are the ways that the Fed, specific ways that the Fed would try to increase inflation, hit those inflation targets you talked about, and then how would that relate to the debt problems.
So in terms of the how would you go about, basically, if you're trying to achieve a higher inflation rate, the way you do that is by providing more stimulus than you would otherwise. I mean, if you want to target an inflation rate of 2% after 2018, that says something about how much stimulus, how low interest rates would be. So this would be saying that the rate of increase in interest rates would be even slower than you would expect, than you would typically expect to get to 2% inflation. You would raise them even more slowly in order to have further stimulus. I haven't thought through the impact on the debt in general. Having higher inflation than was targeted, I think it really depends on what time frame you're talking about. If you're talking about over a very long time frame, we're basically trying to get prices back to where they were supposed to be. And so it's really a wash in terms of the debt. That's really what we're trying to achieve, is actually make that nominal debt that people are borrowing in, make it safe in real terms, so that they know what those dollars mean in terms of the goods and services they can buy.
A question over here off to my left. Identify yourself quickly and then pose your question.
Craig Wildfang, Robbins, Kaplan, Miller, and Cerisi. Doctor, the Congress is not generally associated with making optimal economic decisions, and I wonder what the economic evidence says that proves that 2% is the proper inflation target, and what would it be if it was 3%?
I think this is a good question. I think the arguments for 2% inflation really go back to the 90s, and there are trade-offs between two forces. One is that higher inflation is generally associated with worse economic outcomes. So if you have high enough inflation, that's going to lead to poor economic outcomes, and that's a correlation you can see in cross-country evidence. On the other hand, the downside of keeping inflation low is that also implies that long-term interest rates will be low, and you're more likely then to run into the problem we just are running into. The fact that we're at the zero lower bound, and it's very hard for us to provide stimulus to the economy when we're at the zero lower bound. So let me back up and explain what I mean by that. Typically, the way you would try to facilitate a more rapid recovery in unemployment and inflation back to target after a recession is by lowering interest rates. But once you hit zero, it's hard to go much lower than that. And so the way to avoid that is to the way to avoid that is to have a higher long-term inflation rate, because that pushes up on long-term interest rates as well. So that's a trade-off that people wrestled with in the 90s, and they came up with a conclusion of 2% inflation. 3% inflation is more costly because it incurs these higher costs associated with inflation. On the other hand, it would help you with that zero lower bound problem, and that would be something you'd have to talk. That's the trade-offs between those two things are end up being, I think, model specific, and it would depend on the details of your analysis.
Question here,
Brown Shoe, and I hope I can do this. I have a two-part question. One is, there's often a discussion about around the basket of goods that are considered in the inflationary cycle measurement, whether those are the right basket and whether they've changed. And then the next one is that we have a massive number of people who are moving from the workforce on a natural basis into the retirement force. And because they're moving into that retirement force, they're depending on either savings or the government for income. That income is being frozen because there's no earnings on their retirement dollars. Is therefore our policy of low interest rates not affecting our recovery and slowing it down because approximately one-third of the population's income is frozen?
So let me talk about both those things. Actually, if I could have the slides back, it would be great. I can answer the second question without the slides. So the second question is about the impact on savers. And so we want to be careful about what we mean by savers when we talk about this. It's really talking about people who have to roll over money from one investment to another, right? Because, in fact, if you have a long-term, in 2007, you were the owner of an annuity. It's paying off over a long period of time. The fact that inflation's been as low as it has, you've actually won out compared to what you would have expected in 2007. The stock market being as high as it is, actually for a lot of people who are also, some people wear different hats in the financial life. So some of them are, some people who are, when they come to roll over their money, they also have lots of money in the stock market at the same time. So the appreciation in the stock market since March of 2009 has actually been beneficial for them. So we have to be careful about just saying, savers have been hurt. It's actually pretty nuanced and complicated to try to figure out what's happened. With all that said, on balance, the incentive forces associated with low interest rates push in the direction. There's been a lot of work on this. We feel very confident saying the incentive forces of low interest rates are to generate a force to say people spend now, not later. And that's what policy is about. And the reason we want to do that is to facilitate a more rapid return of inflation and employment to our desired goals. Now, let me talk about the second question you raised, or the first question you raised, actually, David, which is about what inflation rate do we look at? So there's the inflation rate we target includes all goods and services. It includes, in particular, food and energy goods. So we're not leaving those out. When we say we're targeting 2% inflation, everything is in there. Sometimes you'll hear central bankers talk about core inflation. And the reason they talk about it is because our tools operate with a lag. And we have to try to figure out where inflation is going to be, not where it is today. This is not an easy thing to do. So if you look at the middle of 2008 in this picture, you'll see the inflation rate is 4%. Now, this is the inflation rate including everything, all goods and services. Why is it 4%? It's because the price of oil is zooming upwards in the first part of 2008. If you had said to yourself at that point, well, boy, it looks like inflation is going to be high for a long period to come, you would have been really wrong. In fact, you see inflation collapsing at this point. And this is why people strip out energy goods and food goods, is because they're so volatile and they're not as informative as they should be about where inflation is going to be going down the road. So we use core as a way to tell us where the variable we're interested in, inflation for everything, is going to be going. And that's why you'll hear central bankers talk about core inflation.
We have another question over on this side of the room.
Ed Bach, for over almost 100 years, your primary objective was stability, monetary stability. Now you have a second objective, and that's employment. Might that not cause you to have to compromise on some of the decisions that you make on a monetary side, and is that a good thing?
So I've given speeches about this. If you have two objectives in principle, you do have the potential for a conflict. And it's worth thinking about what that means. It's an intellectual question. It's an academic question, because that's not the problem we face right now. Inflation is low. Employment is low. So really, our forecast for both those variables is low relative to where we would like them to be for our country. So doing the right thing with respect to employment is doing the right thing with respect to prices. Doing the right thing with respect to prices is doing the right thing with respect to employment. And typically, the kinds of shocks the economy is usually hit by, we do expect those goals to typically be complementary. Having said that, there may well be circumstances, and we're not in them right now, but there may well be circumstances at times where you do face a conflict. And that's really, I would say, above my pay grade. That's Congress's goal, decision to set those objectives for us. I personally think I like the dual mandate because if you look around the central banks around the world, many of them have only one objective: inflation. Keep inflation at 2% or whatever their target rate is. But there are always caveats written in about we're watching the real economy to make sure we're not doing too much damage to it. And so they owe, even if they have a target of 2%, they're taking into account what's going on in the real economy. Congress, I think, has been wise to say to you, let's be explicit about that. You're going to be watching the real economy anyways. Let's tell the American people that's what you're doing. So I think of that as a more honest approach to monetary policy. But it's absolutely up to Congress. You know, if Congress says target prices, price stability is our only goal, that's, you know, that's up to them.
Well, we have to wrap this up if we're going to keep on schedule, which is our tradition. I suppose both Mark and I could be flattered that you actually gave Congress some credit for getting something right. But I think I can speak for both of us in saying that throughout our congressional tenure, we were constantly hearing from people that we needed to get rid of the Federal Reserve. Think of 535 members of Congress trying to make these decisions. So I think we can credit a Congress of 100 years ago for setting up the Federal Reserve, and I think you gave us ample evidence today as to what a wise move that was. So thank you so much. Here's your paperweight. Since you're an annual speaker, this is probably going in your trophy case, along with the other paperweights we've given you. But help me thank our guest speaker.
Thanks a lot. Thank you so much.